Darkwraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for autumn semester 2015. Lecture 8, delivered on September 21, 2015. The title of this lecture is Interest Rates and Yields.
Today, interest rates and yields. And I've gone through this topic before, and as I have warned you in the past, I don't want that up here anymore. I've gone through this in the past. And like I've told you before in this class, I will introduce a subject, and then I will come back and visit it again. Now, that's supposed to be muted. There. So, look. Oh, no, let me do this. Interest rate. Madam, what's another word that I might use that is the same as interest rate? Yield. What's another one? Can you give me one? Nope. You. Woman? Huh? Nothing? Oh, cool. You got one? Nothing? You were almost there. I was so close. What?
Percentage rate?
No, slap him across the head. No. How about a discount rate? APR. APR, yeah, I know. You both were kind of came very close. There are a lot of words, and in a sense, they all mean the same thing. You're going to use them to change an amount of money to another amount of money. They have slightly different nuances of meaning, which kind of come as the course goes along. Another one is a fancier term for an interest rate is an opportunity cost of capital. And that's one that is kind of subtle, but it's important for us to understand that, look, if I spend money in one way now, the most important thing I ask myself is, what could I have done with that money instead? Think about it this way. You got $1 million, and for a city, you could get $1 million in financing. No, let's say $15 million. Now, you are considering building a stadium, a sports stadium. Okay. Now, there's going to be money that comes in from that. What else could you have done with that $15 million? Anything?
I think you're going to need more than $15 million to build a stadium.
Well, no, we're going to go cheap, and then it's going to go into bankruptcy, and then some rich vultures will pick it up at pennies on the dollar and turn it into a big win for them while the taxpayers are left with the money. I mean, that's capitalism, for God's sake, boy. But what else could you have done with the $15 million?
Invested it.
In what? Borrowed the money and then used that money to invest in something? Well, you could have done that. You might have been able to fix a few roads so that they, you know, people didn't kill themselves on the roads. We could have invested in a new sewer system so that the first time that too many people flush the toilet, everyone's sewer line explodes and then they've got a real fun family room in the basement. There are a lot of other things that you can do with capital. And one of the things that we have to ask ourselves in business, okay, we got this great idea for how we're going to spend our money. But every time we spend money, we are not spent on one thing. We're not spending it on something else. So the question that we have is, what is the opportunity cost? Of the best alternative we give up by spending money on this project. What is it that we give up in terms of a return on investment? okay, we're going to build this facility over here. What if we were to do something else with this money? What would be the return on the best other thing we could get, we could do? And therein lies one of the most important ways to think of an interest rate in business. What else could we have done instead of what we did? I'm thinking of hiring you. But what else could I do with that money?
Continuing education for somebody else.
I could train someone else to become better. I could buy, I could rent a robot. I could outsource it to India or to China or to Vietnam. I could do something else with that money. So in other words, you have a cost to you. What is your cost? Okay, you're going to want more than someone that I could hire elsewhere. What justifies that cost? What justifies that? Can you tell me anything about yourself? No, nothing personal. No, seriously. Above, like, the waist. Long walks on the beach, oh, yeah. You know, Barry Manilow music.
Yeah. Let's see. I mean, your education would be part of your value.
Education is part of the value. Clearly, you are highly educated. Have you ever seen how fast a Chinese worker can calculate without a calculator?
Yeah.
Don't give me that crap. Anyway, the point, though, is that we have to consider everything in terms of what do we give up. In business, our whole thinking changes from what it is in our normal lives. We blow money on things we don't even think about. Have you ever bought a cheeseburger and never didn't think about, well, what else could I have done with this money? Could I have invested this in a good stock? Did you think about that when you bought your last burger?
No.
No, you didn't. We don't think about that. Yeah. See, and that's one of the important things is that in business, we have to think in a way that's different from how we do. We do stupid things in our normal lives. Even though, in a way, they're rational, they're not the way we think in business. Okay, now I'm going to give you some terminology. I'm just sort of random terminology about debt. First things first is the principal. There's a word that I've already used that is not principal, but it essentially is the same thing as principal in a lot of problems that you encounter, kind of like math problems that you encounter. Can you think of it's a two-word term, instead of principal, that has the same meaning? Yeah?
Present value.
I love it. Oh, my God. Wow. Present value. Yeah, the beginning amount. And along the way, in the next lecture, I'll show you how you can, in a loan, you can find out after so many payments what your balance is left. That'll be the principal. So in a way, the principal is the present value. It's also another word for it is the price now. The price now of the debt instrument. Okay. Debt service. Debt service is the part, is what you are paying that is interest on the principal. Now, when a corporation or a government entity issues debt, all it pays along the way is interest. So in other words, it is servicing the debt. That's all it's doing is servicing the debt. In consumer loans, there is also amortization. Amortization is paying down on the principal, draining out. So with a loan that amortizes, the debt service declines because the amount of the principal is declining, therefore the service amount is declining. You've heard me use this term before, and it's real old school, but it's still around. The term kicker. And I'm pretty sure your book doesn't use a term, but it does show you the concept a couple of places. A kicker is an extraordinary amount, usually at the beginning or at the end of a loan. Something that is just like, okay, we're going to have a loan where you're going to pay it down, and then at the end, you're going to pay an extra amount. That would be like a lease. A lease, if you have the option to buy at the end, that's called a kicker at the end. Sometimes there are some kinds of debt instruments. There are all kinds of exotica out there in the debt world. One that is out there has like a kicker that is paid at a certain point along the way of the debt, where they just kind of suddenly whoomp, and the amount that they owe the lenders goes down. Now, you can choose to do a kicker. When you're making payments on a mortgage, you can actually pay an extra amount of money anytime you want. Interestingly, at least in the old days, and it's still true to this day, a lot of banks charge you a fee for if you throw a kicker on, simply because what you're doing is you are shortening the life of the loan on them. You are doing something unexpected, and unexpected means risk. So they will say, well, that's nice of you to do this, but, you know, we're going to hurt you for it. We're going to give you a little spanking for that. But kickers are out there. You've heard me use the term before, and I'll use it again. Now, APR is the annual percentage rate, APR. That is just, if you buy a car this week, you're going to get an APR of 3.59%. Okay, that's just the interest rate that they're charging you. The effective yield is what that interest rate really is when you take into account, the compounding that's happening. And as I said, the effective yield formula is real fast to calculate. And I mean the quiz, in the chapter tests and quizzes, you'll see it there. All you do is you take 1 plus the APR divided by the number of payments per year divided by the number of payments. To the number of payments per year. Minus one. Don't forget to subtract the one off at the end. Don't forget that. Otherwise, it kind of looks like an interest rate. When you get it, it's like 1.0529. It's actually 0.0529. Just don't forget to take that off there. Other than that, this is just a straight-up formula. Required by law that in any debt contract, they have to disclose the APR, but they also have to disclose the effective yield as well. They also have to disclose the effective yield as well. And that is the extent of that part of the lecture. Now I'm going to go to the next part here, where the question comes down, why are we charging interest rates? In the capitalist model, we induce surplus capital to go to those who need it. In other words, deficit economic units, agents, buy a reward. And that's called an interest rate. The interest rate that will be charged is based upon the risk of the investment, as well as macroeconomic factors, the expected inflation rate and the real rate of money. Don't forget this concept right here. First of all, the actual interest rate that you would see on any debt instrument would be the risk-free rate plus a risk premium. And I've done this before, and now I'm going back through it in a little more detail. The risk-free rate is the real rate of return plus the expected inflation premium. We call this a nominal rate. Nominal. Any time you subtract off the expected inflation premium, you get a real rate, an adjusted rate. Sometimes they'll say an inflation-adjusted rate. The problem with doing this is that oftentimes in sloppy modeling, all we do is subtract off the inflation rate that's published by the government. Now, the problem with that is twofold. One is that's a historical rate. That's not the expected rate. That's the rate that has already happened. Now, if inflation is stable, the expected rate will probably be around the historical rate. You see what I mean? Like, if inflation has been going 2%, 2%, 2%, 2%, well, the actual expected inflation rate is probably about 2%. So it wouldn't hurt to subtract off the expected to subtract off 2%. But if inflation is going up or down or is all over the board, the expected inflation rate, which you should subtract if you want to get a real rate from a nominal rate, that would be a little bit harder to call. You'd have to look up what the researchers are estimating it is for the time being. Seriously? No, of course I don't want that to stay on mute. I obviously want that thing back on. Damn it. Anyway, okay. But anytime you have inflation as part of it, that's a nominal rate. Now, here's the deal. Borrowers benefit from inflation. Why? Why do borrowers benefit from inflation? Got any idea? Can you give me an idea? Why would a borrower benefit from inflation? Okay. Try it this way. Suppose that you borrow for a house. A nice neighborhood, good economy. You borrow, let's say, $200,000. Okay, so now, your payments are going to come in maybe about $1,300 a month. Now, will those payments ever change as long as you stay in the house? Will the value of your house change as inflation pushes through the economy? So in other words, the actual real value of your payments, which are staying level in nominal terms, is going to erode. Your salary is going to go up. Your house is going to go up in value, as long as you don't have a housing crisis or something. So you're going to do better. Inflation is going to help you because your salary will be going up with inflation. Your house value will be going up. But your payments are going to stay fixed. $1,300 today, if inflation roars at about 4% for 10 years, and your salary is keeping up with it, $1,300 is going to be a joke of a payment in 10 years. You got the idea of why inflation benefits borrowers? That, of course, is why banks don't like inflation. They get all kinds of excited, because it erodes the purchasing power of the payments that they are getting on fixed rate instruments. So now comes the next part. I'll try to do this quickly. Return briefly to the yield curve. Okay, Google, yield curve, stock charts. There it is. Now I'm going to unmute this. And I'm going to turn off the light for a second here. Okay. So, they got an index here. This is Standard & Poor's 500 index. Well, first we'll look at the yield curve. Let me pull it back just a little hair to last week. Now, the Fed, there was a lot of sentiment that they were going to try to bump interest rates up a little bit. They did not. And so look at what happened to the expectation. Do you see what happened? The dark was last week, and as the Fed, it became clear that the Fed was not going to do it. Look how it settled back down. Even more importantly, though, out here on the long end of the yield curve, and this is the kind of question that would be a little more complicated, but I could ask it on an essay question. I could say, here's the yield curve 4 weeks ago. Here's the yield curve now. Explain what you are seeing. In this case, notice that this long end, which is more about expectations, long-term expectations of inflation, more about long-term expectations of economic activity, notice how that long end pulled back. That might not be a good sign because, in a way, the markets are saying, yeah, inflation really isn't going to be a problem for a long time. And it looks as if there's going to be not as much demand for capital, in other words, economic expansion, out here on the long term as we had thought last week. Now, great news. It's going down. Another thing, though, that you want to watch is in the intermediate. Did the intermediate ease up as much as the long? Looks like it did. However, tell me what would happen if this begins to hold stable while the long end begins to drop harder, which it just started to do. You see here how the long end, rather the intermediate, had already pretty much finished its job of going down. And now the long end is dropping in the last couple of days. Why would that scare the hell out of me? Why would I begin to get, not scare the hell out of me, but why would I begin to get worried if I see that? In other words, if I start to see the yield curve, the whole yield curve is dropping. There's the yield curve. It's all dropping together. Why does that worry me? What am I seeing happen? Anyone want to remember from what I showed you before?
Is it deflation?
Not deflation, no. Something even worse. I'm seeing the beginning of a run towards an inverted yield curve. What does an inverted yield curve mean? What has happened? What has followed inverted yield curves?
Recessions.
Not every inverted yield curve has led to a recession, but every recession has been preceded by an inverted yield curve. What I see happening here, just a tiny, tiniest hint, just a whisper, is a yield curve that is beginning to show something that I don't like. Down the road, if I start to see that, I might eventually see that. There is a technical inversion. A shorter yield is higher than a longer yield. That's an inverted yield curve. I'm just seeing a tiny nuance that the yield curve is starting to think about maybe playing with that idea a little more. It's not there at all. It's just... I just see it right here in this last bit. just a tiny bit, that long end is dropping out here. So you have this nice robust. And then as you pull in, something is kind of worrying me. The short long end of the yield curve. See how the long end of the yield curve was rising there? See that? See how it was rising to keep an inversion from happening? But then that long end stopped doing that. And now it's been settling backwards, downward. It's not anything too much to worry about, but there's just a slight hint. Now over here, you will notice that if we take this out, well, I'm not going to do that too much. But the point here being that a yield curve plots the yield on government debt securities of different maturities. That's all it does. It plots the yield on government debt securities of different maturities. And I could ask you that as just a simple, straight-up question. Explain what a yield curve is. What is a yield curve? Don't go into some long, complicated explanation, because I will then go on to ask you to go into an explanation of something. What is an inverted yield curve, and why does it concern us? That's a question for an exam. A classic. What is an inverted yield curve? And why is it of concern? Well, an inverted yield curve is a yield curve where a shorter rate is a shorter yield. A yield on a shorter debt obligation is higher than the yield on a longer maturity debt obligation. And it concerns us because every recession has been preceded by an inverted yield curve. That's a perfect answer. You get all the points, and you're done in like 2 minutes of writing. And that's what I expect, is short and hit me over the head with the right answer. Okay, one more thing about this. I'm going to go to this database right here. Fred Savage, what the hell? Looking at Fred Savage. He's not as good looking as I am, so he can go to hell. The Federal Reserve Economic Database is one of the most amazing little things that you'll ever want to try. Categories. Let's try interest rates. Going to interest rate spreads, LIBOR, long-term securities, money market accounts, mortgage rates. Let's try something. Interest rates on Treasury bills. Let's do 3-month T-bills monthly. No, let's do daily. Okay. That should be enough to start us. Now let me see if I can get this to go. Stop that. Okay. And I'm going to first show you this. Seriously? Okay. This is a Fred graph. Now you can lay these graphs over and over on each other. Let's get this in here. 2000. Let's do the year 2000. Okay. There is a knock dead presentation of what interest rates on T-bill yields have done. Notice, interestingly enough, that the Fed, even before the Great Recession hit, the Fed was starting to pee its pants a little bit and trying to bring down through open market operations. They were trying to pump money into the market through OMOs. It wasn't doing too much. It wasn't enough because it was already too late. They'd already sealed the deal from 2004 through 2008. They were starving M1, driving T-bill yields up, and that pretty much, poof, snap, and the economy was dead. And then they've been bobbling along at about zero, almost zero, ever since as the economy picks up. Quick note here. The gray bands are recessions. The Federal Reserve used to show no gray band here because there was no recession. They justified their actions during the craze for tax cuts by saying that we were in a recession. And years later, they went back and added a recession that did not happen with this gray band here. I still have the graphs that were produced by Fred before they altered history slightly to explain themselves. But as you can see, look what you can see the action of the Fed. See what the Fed was doing? It was choking the markets. M1 was going up because their open market operations were clearly contractionary. You saw the graph that I showed you of M1, what they were doing with M1. There's no doubt about it. They starved out the economy, and snap, the economy just went into a downfall, into a crash. Now what I want to do is go back here, and I'm going to bring up, come on, seriously? 1 year, I want a 10-year yield. Let's get off that. Okay, add to the graph now. What I want to do next is, and you can download this data too, and I want to put in something else here. I want to, first of all, get this back to 1000, yeah, back in the Middle Ages, 2000. Okay, so there is the graph. Now, I'm also going to, let me pull up the next one that I want to show you here. If I can do this, graph settings, add a data series, a Fred series, type keywords for data. Thirty-year, constant maturity. Add the series. Okay, now let's make the graph. If I can, frequency, percent. Come on, where is it? Huh? I wanted to do this next graph. Okay, I wanted to do the graph. Where am I missing? Okay, oh. Graph, add data, edit data series. No, that's fine, I don't wanna. How do I get my graph back? Where is it? Okay. Oh, there it is. Yeah, sure. Okay, now let me show you something interesting here. The red one is 30-year debt instruments. You see this gap in here? We had done so good on paying off our national debt and getting our budget deficit under control in the 1990s, we actually didn't need to issue 30-year debt instruments anymore. We stopped issuing them. Okay, so now, first of all, the spread. Why is there, first of all, a spread between a 3-month T-bill yield and a 30-year Treasury bond yield? Why is there a spread to begin with? What is it? From the quiz. You know? Got even a guess? Why would there be a spread? Why is there a spread? What? No. It's the maturity premium. Yeah, remember that they are both completely safe instruments. The only difference is that a 30-year debt instrument, no matter who issues it, is subject to volatility of long-term economic uncertainty. So you will naturally see the yield of a longer debt instrument above the yield of a shorter debt instrument. Now, let's talk about spread. The spread is a thing that would be of most concern because the spread would represent economic uncertainty and possibly the effect of expectations of inflation way out the road. But notice how the spread between these, if you look carefully, see how the spread got shorter and smaller and smaller. That would mean that the maturity premium was getting less and less. Less economic uncertainty in the long run means a lower risk maturity premium in the risk premium. It also means lack of concern about inflation exploding way out in the 30-year range, in the 20 to 30-year range. But then, notice how it got a little stronger. But then something interesting happened. Look how tight the spread's gotten down there. It started to go back up here. But you see how even when it hit a peak, that peak was along something we call a neckline. See how this neckline that's going along here is getting lower and lower? In other words, each peak in the spot is smaller than the last one, which means that overall, the spread between a very short-term treasury bill and a long-term treasury bond has been narrowing. Even on the bottoms have been narrowing too, both the tops and the bottoms. What I'm showing you here, and I wanted to have a chance to do this, I'm showing you technical analysis. This is actual technical analysis. You're looking at spreads, you're looking at tops and trends in tops, and bottoms and the trends in the bottoms. Look at this. You see how the tops, this neckline, just keeps getting lower and lower? And how the bottoms, they're kind of shallowing out too. In other words, this is a smoothing out. There's a narrowing and it's getting down to virtually nothing. That's probably why the Fed didn't change the interest rates. It's seeing that it looks like a seriously stable situation right now. Worries on the horizon, yeah, but with a yield spread like this, why would you care? One last thing that I want to show you something here. I want to show you something. Add a data series. S-P. Here we go. Well, that sucked. I lost that one. Never mind that one. Kill that one. Trash that one. It's not going to work. Okay, one last thing here. I'll show you one more. Come on, I want to get rid of this one. Trash this one. Yep, throw this one in the trash. Remove, and then I'm going to show you this one. Add a data series. Corporate bonds. AAA corporate bonds from Moody's. Add the series. This is what corporate bonds are doing. Notice how closely they mirror the 30-year treasury bond. But they don't mirror it completely. What you're looking for in this one is the spread. Do you see how that spread has been very constant for a long, long time? But look here. The spread's beginning to open a little bit. Again, nuance. This is how you look at the data. And at the end of the semester, you're going to be asked to do an analysis like this, just on a picture on your final exam. What do you see? Explain. And that's going to be a major part of the exam, is you beginning to look at this data and say, all right, as a corporate decision maker, I'm beginning to see that corporate bonds are starting to pull upward a little bit harder than their government bond equivalents. That means that I probably will want to add more to a debt instrument as far as the coupon goes than I used to over a 30-year treasury bond. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.